Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In the first hour of the program today, we will be talking with an expert on American Indian law. His name is Robert Williams. He's the E. Thomas Sullivan Professor of Law and American Indian Studies, and also Director of the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program at the University of Arizona Rogers College of Law in Tucson. He's also an enrolled member of the Lumbee Indian Tribe of North Carolina. He's authored several books and many papers dealing with this issue. Just to mention the titles of a few, The American Indian and Western Legal Thought, and also Linking Arms Together, American Indian Treaty Visions of Law and Peace, 1600 to 1800. Those books both published by the Oxford University Press. He's also the co-author of a text that's used in law school, Federal Indian Law, Cases and Materials. His most recent book, titled Like a Loaded Weapon, The Rehnquist Court, Indian Rights, and the Legal History of Racism in America. In addition to teaching at Arizona, he has also taught at Harvard, at University of Washington Law School, also University of Wisconsin Law School, and the Rutgers Law School. He was on the campus a couple of weeks ago. He was scheduled to be here on this program, and unfortunately I had to be away, and we ended up remaking the schedule and weren't able to talk to him. We're pleased, though, that he could be joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome, questions from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that they just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along, get in as many different people as possible. Of course, anyone who's listening is certainly welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Again, any point here, people want to be involved in the conversation, all they have to do is pick up the telephone, give us a call. Professor Williams, hello.
Yes, good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us. This is a complex area, and I'm not exactly sure where to plunge in, but one place that I think it makes sense maybe to start, I don't know if this is too fundamental, but I think it's probably a good place to start, is to ask you to talk a little bit about the doctrine of discovery.
Well, that's a good place to start, because it really is at the beginning, particularly as far as relationships between American Indian tribes and Europeans. Back in the 1400s, when Columbus set sail for what he thought was going to be a shorter spice route to Japan. He was chasing things like silks and spices. He approached the Spanish king and queen and asked for a charter of discovery. At the time, in the 1490s, Europeans believed that wherever they sailed and discovered lands that were not occupied by heathens, infidels, and savages, those were the three categories, that European Christians had the right to take those lands occupied by those non-Christian peoples and claim them for their own and exercise sovereignty and dominion and begin to colonize them. So what arose out of these colonizing practices was this doctrine of discovery, which basically meant that the first European discoverer had the superior rights to lands occupied by non-Christian savages. In this case, in America, American Indians were regarded as savage peoples. And in 1823, in a very famous U.S. Supreme Court Indian law decision by Chief Justice John Marshall, the U.S. Supreme Court said that indeed the doctrine of discovery was the doctrine under which America was settled and colonized, and it would be the law of the United States. So for contemporary purposes, it's a fascinating history, but more importantly, what the doctrine does is give the United States Congress plenary power over Indian affairs. And that's a very rare power in the Constitution. Congress essentially has plenary power over the right to declare war, over immigration, and Indian affairs, because at the time the Constitution was written, of course, Indian affairs really were a matter of military concern. You had Great Britain retreating to Canada with its tribal allies. You had Spain with its tribal allies. So this idea of the doctrine of discovery gives Congress extraordinary powers unbounded by the Constitution when it comes to legislating for Indian affairs. And it all relates to the doctrine of discovery. One more final point is sort of a little legal primer here for your listeners, and that is that the doctrine also recognizes tribal sovereignty. It does recognize the right of Indian self-government. But that right of sovereignty, of self-government, and of territory is constrained by the overriding principle that Congress does have plenary power.
Yeah. And just not to make too fine a point on it, but you have to stress that this was not just something that happened at what ended up becoming the United States. Colonial powers did this everywhere, and essentially wherever they arrived, they said whatever sort of governmental structures or legal systems that indigenous people thought they had, the colonizers began with the basic idea that our laws trump yours.
That's right, that these systems had no legitimacy. Interestingly, Australia cites Johnson v. McIntosh and Chief Justice Marshall when it adopts the doctrine of discovery. New Zealand adopts the doctrine. Canada adopts the doctrine. In fact, all of the Western settler states, the English-speaking states, and even to a degree in Latin America, and at some points even in colonial Africa, accepted this idea that Europeans did have these superior rights over indigenous peoples.
Well, you said at the same time, though, the Doctrine of Discovery also recognizes tribal sovereignty. I guess I'm not really quite sure how that squares with the idea that's with the first idea, the basic idea that says the newcomers, the colonial powers, the outsiders were saying, well, our system of laws is now going to be the system of laws. I guess I'm not exactly sure how you can say that and at the same time have some notion of tribal sovereignty.
Well, lawyers have worked with that because the basic idea is that while Congress has what's called superior sovereignty, tribes have diminished sovereignty, and by that it means that the incantation that lawyers use in Indian law is whatever hasn't been taken away by Congress remains. So until Congress exercises its plenary power and, for example, reduces the tribal land base, a treaty is a good way to understand this unique legal relationship. Tribes make a claim to large areas of what are called aboriginal lands, lands they've traditionally occupied and owned and hunted and fished over. The generals come out from the U.S. Army and say, well, we have white settlers here. We need to reduce your aboriginal territories. The tribes agree to a reduced territory, annuities, guarantees of health benefits in the treaties, for example. And what's left is what's reserved out of that aboriginal territory. And that's where you get the idea of a reservation. Now, within that reservation, Congress hasn't said anything about what tribal rights are, and courts and lawyers take the position that whatever hasn't been taken away remains. Within that reservation, tribes retain their diminished sovereignty. Now, Congress can come along, as it has, and impose restrictions on that sovereignty within the reservation. They can impose a criminal code. They can impose U.S. laws. They can impose environmental laws. They can impose the Endangered Species Act. But until Congress expressly passes legislation invading the tribe's sovereignty, its diminished sovereignty within its reservation, that power remains. So you look at it as very similar to the Constitution. You have the federal government with certain superior powers under the Constitution. You also have rights of states guaranteed as well. And so the founders were very comfortable with working with different notions of sovereignty and different powers of sovereignty in different governments. And they replicated that model when it came to Indian tribes as well.
Well, what exactly is the relationship between the tribe and the tribal government within its reserve territory and the federal government of the United States?
Well, you're really talking about three different levels of concern. You have the federal government, the tribal government, and tribal members themselves. The federal government has the power and has, in the past, for example, enacted legislation guaranteeing Indian people's civil rights. You have the 1968 Indian Civil Rights Act passed in conjunction with the larger Civil Rights Act. And in that legislation, Congress said that when tribal governments deal with their citizens, they have to provide them due process, they have to provide equal protection, they have to recognize a right to counsel. So many of the same guarantees of the Bill of Rights are also guaranteed to individual tribal members. However, what's interesting is, and many people, my students included, are somewhat shocked when they find this out, it's well established going back to the early 1900s that the larger constitutional Bill of Rights does not apply to Indian country. And so many of the rights that tribal individuals have are only appealable within the tribal legal system. A tribal member, for example, if there's a controversy over membership, that the last right of appeal is within the tribal courts, for example. You can't go into federal district court and challenge a tribal decision. The one area where Congress has made an exception is in criminal jurisdiction. If a tribe locks you up and you feel that you've your rights have been violated, you can file a tribal member can file a federal habeas corpus petition to the federal court, and then a federal district judge will test the legality of that detention. But you know, because we're talking about this principle of tribal sovereignty, there are many areas over reservation life where both Indians and non-Indians are subject to tribal jurisdiction, and the final right of appeal is within the tribe.
Mm-hmm. And I know that from time to time there has been some controversy over this notion. Is it not the case that at least in some places that what tribes have done is that they have developed a kind of a parallel Bill of Rights? It may not be exactly the same as that appended to the Constitution, but essentially makes some of the same kind of guarantees.
That's right. I am actually a tribal judge for two tribes, and each of the tribes I work for has its own constitution and has its own Bill of Rights. And we enforce and interpret that Bill of Rights according to tribal custom and traditions in our courts. And so it's not unusual, for example, to see a tribal court judge weighing issues of the tribal constitution, the United States Constitution, the Indian Civil Rights Act, and then the tribal Bill of Rights. And so it can become quite complicated.
Well, if one asks a question, I realize this is the big question, but ask a question that, like this. How, over the last couple of hundred years, how well has the government of the United States done, the federal government done, in honoring and to the extent that it has that responsibility, trying to preserve and protect rights of Indian people, where we're looking at the same kind of rights that any citizen of the United States has?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, if you talk to Indian people, the most important rights they have are the rights guaranteed by their treaties, and there are no other groups of citizens within the U.S. that have that unique right. Now, scholars have gone through every treaty ever negotiated and have been able to find that the United States has breached every single treaty in some aspect that it ever negotiated with tribes. So in terms of the guarantees that are contained in those documents for tribal cultural survival, I mean, if you look at those treaties, what they do, in fact, is guarantee tribal cultural survival. One of the most basic rights of any culture under modern human rights law is the right to continue to develop as a people, as a culture, to use your own language. We know, for example, in the 1800s that Congress instituted a policy with the BIA of boarding schools, which tried to eradicate Indian culture. In the late 19th century, Congress violated hundreds of treaties in enacting so-called land reform legislation that was designed to break up and allot the reservation. So the answer to your question on the treaties is that historically Congress has done an absolutely horrible job, that many historians would look at the history of U.S.-Indian relations and conclude that if not genocide, then perhaps ethnocide might be an appropriate term. The conscious intent to destroy a culture. I think most historians, Indian as well as non-Indians, would agree that there was that conscious intent there. As you move into the 1960s and the Civil Rights era, and as Indian people themselves begin to get a bigger voice in national politics and national government, you see a much better job of enforcing the treaty rights over the last several decades. And so that's why you do have so many successful tribes, that they're able to perpetuate their culture under that unique federal protection. Now, individual rights, in terms of comparing the rights of individual Indians to United States citizens, many people are shocked to learn that Indians weren't even given citizenship by Congress until the 1920s. Many had fought in World War I, and so it was felt appropriate to guarantee them citizenship rights. But until the 1920s, Indians were treated as wards of the federal government, essentially, as people unable to take care of themselves. And that's why you were able to get, for example, policies of forced sterilization of Indian women in IHS hospitals, why you're able to get an entire code promulgated by the federal government designed to destroy and persecute and prosecute practitioners of traditional Indian religions. And so the record on individual rights isn't that much better either if you look through our history up until perhaps the last 30 or 40 decades, where now in individual Indian rights you've had major Indian voting rights cases, you have school desegregation, Many Indian children were segregated from non-Indian schools, for example. So, again, you know, the history is a difficult thing to talk about because there's just some things that happened that are absolutely horrible. Contemporary times, as tribes have adopted, you know, their own voice and taken to advocating their rights, the record is a lot better.
Our guest is Robert Williams in this hour of Focus 580. He's professor of law and American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona Rogers College of Law in Tucson. He's also director of the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program there. And we're talking about this question of whether or not the law, how and what sort of job the law has done in protecting the rights of Indigenous people. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller to bring into the conversation, and of course, people who are listening are welcome. We'll go here to our toll free line number 4. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This is somewhat related, and so perhaps your guest could briefly tell me where to start on this. I've been told by my parents, who are long gone, and my uncles, that I am part American Indian of the Potawatomi tribe, and I believe it would be 1/16 for great-great grandparents. And I have no idea where to start to try to prove that or accomplish anything. Does he have any suggestions just where I could start to try to uncover that?
Yeah, I can answer that. My first response is anybody but the Potawatomis. There are a large number, relatively speaking, of separate Potawatomi bands. It's a very interesting tribe. The first thing I would suggest is that you do some reading on the history of the tribe. The best source I would recommend is by the Smithsonian Institute. It's called The Handbook of North American Indians. And you'll see a great entry there on the Potawatomis. And what will be most interesting is that you'll see an entry on the different Potawatomi bands that have reservations in several different states. So my short advice to you is to get that list. You can also go to the Bureau, to the Department of Interior, into their website and locate tribes that carry that Potawatomi name. You'll find there's several of them. Each of them that are federally recognized will have an office of enrollment. And usually the office of enrollment is the place where you get started. They're the place that keeps what are called the rolls. Each tribe, usually in the late 1800s, was required by the federal government to set up a membership roll. And that's usually the baseline. If one of your ancestors appear on that membership roll, you can then determine Indian blood quantum and whether there's eligibility for membership. So I think the best thing is to track down the different Potawatomi bands or perhaps get more information from members of your family or even in a family Bible to kind of get a sense of the location of where that ancestor may have been, and then you can kind of match up the band with your specific family history and start there.
Do you know if 1/16th is that too far removed or...
Each tribe, you know, from what we were talking about before, that tribes have sovereign control over their membership, each tribe will define their membership differently. And so some tribes are restrictive in that they may have a one-half or one-quarter blood quantum. Other tribes, it's not unusual to see members who are enrolled who have, you know, 1/32nd or 1/64th. So each tribe differs. So, again, you'll have to do some research on that.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to get back to the question that we were talking about a little earlier, I'm interested. I hope this is not too fine a point. I guess I'm interested in what the legal status of a treaty is, and I would. The only thing that I could think, and maybe this is the wrong comparison, is that it's like a contract in a sense. It is a legally enforceable agreement between two parties, and that there should be and that if one party doesn't hold up their end of the agreement, then it ought to be possible for there to be some adjudication for you to go to a judge or to a court and say, look, we entered into this agreement and the other party failed to fulfill what's specified in the agreement. And if that's the right kind of model, then I'm interested in this the question of if in fact it is true, and I'm sure that it's true, that every treaty the United States ever entered into with Native people was broken in some respect, what sort of record then Indigenous people have had, Native Americans have had, in going to courts and saying, look, we have this agreement. This was legally binding.
Right.
The United States did not fulfill its part of this bargain and this agreement, and so we're entitled to damages or to insist that the terms of the agreement be fulfilled or something like that.
Right. Okay, for the first part of your question, what is a treaty? A contract is a good way to think about it, but I tend to tell my students, think about it as a contract plus. A treaty, whether it's with an Indian tribe or Japan, is the supreme law of the land, as the Supreme Court has said. The power of Congress and the Senate to affirm treaties and of the executive to negotiate them is recognized in the Constitution. It is a constitutional power. And again, because of that long history of international law and the history of treaty making in Europe, the founding fathers regarded the making of a treaty as a sovereign act. So it's a little bit extra than just a contract. At the same time, the courts do interpret these treaties, because under our Constitution, that's where interpretation sometimes falls. Do interpret these treaties as a contract. They look at it as, you know, arm's length bargaining. It's the result of sovereign parties negotiating their own interests. So that's kind of the first part of the question. An Indian treaty is just like a treaty with a foreign nation. It has a contractual set of obligations and duties, but at the same time, because these sovereign interests are involved, courts take them very seriously. Now, the second part of your question, and that is the assertion by historians that every treaty that the U.S. ever entered into with tribes has been broken. Now, the normal recourse for the breach of a treaty, if the U.S. and Japan, for example, are having disagreements, are diplomatic, anywhere from sanctions to boycott to shame to publicizing the breach of a treaty, all the way up to an act of war or withdrawal of ambassadors. Now, tribes, of course, don't have that option. And we also have that other principle we talked about earlier under the doctrine of discovery of congressional plenary power. In fact, courts have held that Congress can break an Indian treaty, and there's not much that tribes can do about it. But because treaties are the law of the land, treaty rights are protected by the Constitution. So if Congress breaches a treaty, then it is obligated under the Constitution to pay just compensation for that treaty right. And there are many cases, and much of what I teach in federal Indian law involves situations where Congress broke a treaty and tribes are able to come before courts and seek just compensation. Now, there are also many instances in history where Congress broke a treaty but doesn't necessarily rise to the level of a just compensation claim under the United States Constitution. In the 1950s, Congress established a special commission, the Indian Claims Commission, which allowed tribes to bring their historical claims before a special adjudicatory body and litigate those claims there. And some of those claims were pleaded under the idea that the Congress or the United States had violated a moral obligation or had acted in bad faith. So in that situation there, Congress had provided remedies. So, you know, that's a long explanation, but again, treaty law is so important to tribes. Let me just say one more thing. In the absence of a treaty, tribes have no protection, and that's why the treaties are so important in federal Indian law and so important to tribes, is that the treaty gives that guarantee of constitutional protection to tribal rights, federal court review, appeal to Congress. For example, Alaska Natives never had a treaty. And so when oil is discovered in Alaska in the 1960s and 70s, they find themselves in a very weak bargaining position because they really have no contractual rights recognized by Congress to the lands of Alaska. And so that gives you an example there where if it's not mentioned in a treaty, it's a much more precarious form of right that tribes have.
Let's talk with some other people who are listening. Next, we'll talk with someone here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, and Champaign specifically, line one. Hello.
Yes, Professor Williams. There's an interesting issue that has arisen a couple of times. I think back in 2002 or thereabouts, it was with the Seminole tribe, and most recently with the Cherokee tribes, and it concerns the membership in the tribes of black freedmen.
That's right.
Or these were blacks who were slaves, in this case of Cherokee and maybe Seminoles before the Civil War. And there was interracial mixing between blacks and members of the tribe, and they've stayed together, I believe, over in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And now the Seminoles back in 2002, and now most recently the Cherokee, very recently in 2007, have denied membership mm-hmm. to the black freedmen, denying them health care benefits and any other perks that go with tribal membership. And I believe that case is not contained solely within the Indian tribal law system, but some of the freedmen, especially with respect to the Cherokee, may file suit in federal district court that has jurisdiction over that subject matter, claiming a violation of a treaty and maybe constitutional violations of rights of the black freedmen. Am I correct in that, and what is the law on that?
Yeah, your analysis is very thorough, and I don't have to say much after your rundown. In fact, the Cherokee freedmen are in court right now. There was a federal district judge who had found that the Cherokees had violated the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, 15th Amendment. Those are the Civil War amendments, which prohibit slavery. The interesting history there is that a good number of the Cherokees sided with the Confederacy in the Civil War, that prior to the 1860s, when the Cherokees were in their ancestral home in the 1820s and 1830s in Georgia and Tennessee, you had intermarriage amongst the Cherokees, not only amongst African Americans, but amongst white missionaries. And so you had a number of what were called half-breed Cherokees who took leadership positions in the tribe, began to invest in plantation agriculture, and held slaves. And so you actually had the institution of African-American chattel slavery adopted by the Cherokees. The Cherokees, of course, along with other southern tribes, were removed in the 1830s to Oklahoma, where they were resettled involuntarily. And during the Civil War, the Cherokees and some of those tribes sided with the Confederacy as part of their peace treaty after the Civil War. They were required in that peace treaty by Congress to recognize their freedmen. Those African-American slaves who had been emancipated. And so that actually is an example of where Congress has utilized its plenary power to override tribal sovereignty. And in most cases, tribes have control over their membership. But this recent federal district judge found that under the 13th Amendment, Congress had exercised its plenary power, and in fact, the people of the country in adopting this constitutional amendment, that any of the prohibitions contained in the 13th Amendment, if a tribe violated those, would be subject to federal court review. So that's where that case is right now. The Cherokees just had an election in which they basically decided that only those who had appeared on one of those original allotment rolls that we had talked about would be eligible for membership. And unfortunately, and again, here's another quirk that people don't understand, it was the federal government after the Civil War that developed two separate rolls of tribal members, the Cherokees and then those who had African-American blood. And it was the federal government that documented that African-American ancestry upon which the case is based right now.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let us continue. And the next caller will be in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I would like to hear some discussion on the water rights and responsibilities that the various tribes might have. And in terms of surface water, I could think of the Missouri that would run alongside of a reservation, and then one could think of rivers that pass through or originate within a reservation. And then there's groundwater, such as the Ogallala Reservoir. So I wonder if you could discuss that a bit.
Yeah, real briefly, because that's a pretty complex topic. I tell my students if they ever want to be continually employed, become an Indian water rights lawyer. These cases in the West here have been going on since shortly after World War II. They involve hundreds of thousands of litigants because it's not unusual to have that many people claiming a stream. The basic place to start is to recognize that west of the Mississippi, most state governments, which do control the water law within their jurisdiction, have adopted some variation of what's called the doctrine of prior appropriation. That is, first in time, first in right. The first settler, the first rancher, the first farmer, the first mining company, the first city that gets out onto the water, a flowing water course, has a right to continue to use that, and everybody else steps in line. And the Supreme Court found back at the turn of the century in the 1900s that was unfair to Indian tribes because the treaties, again, we keep getting back to those treaties, the tribes' treaties had guaranteed their reservations as a place where they could perpetuate their culture. And so since many of those tribes had never appropriated water under state law, they were really standing last in line. And the Supreme Court said that would be a violation of the treaty. And so the Supreme Court creates a doctrine called the Reserved Rights Doctrine. And the Reserved Rights Doctrine holds that when Congress created the reservation, which usually precedes statehood, it impliedly reserved enough water to fulfill the purposes of that reservation. So you have a conflict. You have state water law, which recognizes prior appropriation, and then you have federal law, the law of the land, under the Supremacy Clause, which recognizes this doctrine of reserve rights to tribes. And we've been fighting it out ever since in the West, that fundamental conflict of, you know, who has the better right in an area where there's not much water. Now, groundwater, which particularly here where I'm in Tucson, is a major source of the municipal water supply. Because it's so hot, water doesn't really stay on the surface very long. You have to pump it up underground. Most states have adopted what's called a rule of capture, and that is if you can dig a well and get it to your property, then you have it and no one can interfere with it unless they can dig a deeper well. And there again, the courts have found that Indians were disbenefited. And so in much of this complex litigation, courts are really involved in very complicated hydrological science, trying to figure out the relationship between groundwater, the relationship between surface water, and the relationship between state prior appropriation and capture doctrine and this doctrine of federally reserved rights for Indian tribes. So most of these cases are still ongoing. Eventually, they end up getting negotiated settlements in Congress where you have a division of the waters, and then hopefully everybody can live happily ever after. But as the West grows, it becomes more and more complicated because there simply isn't enough water to go around.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's continue. We'll talk with someone in Belgium, near not too far away, over by Danville, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I have another, probably slightly different sort of question. In the example of, say, Mayan tribes of Mexico, or even the Celts in Europe, they were the indigenous people in those areas at one time, and now they do not exist at all. They've been totally incorporated into the culture that's there. Can that actually happen in our society, since we've got indigenous people and they will slowly be incorporated after millennia into our society?
Well, 2 points. My program actually represents the Maya in Belize in a petition that has been accepted by the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights, because the Belizean government took the exact position that you stated, that the Mayans were no longer extant. In fact, there are vibrant indigenous Mayan cultures throughout Central America. They continue to speak the Mayan language. They continue to, and this is what our case alleges, and we can document and prove, they actually continue to assert their traditional Mayan customary land laws over their territories, even though the state claims they don't exist. I remember being in Great Britain a few years ago and hearing a language which I actually thought was almost English, but not quite, but it was Celtic. And yet I began talking to people in a bar and realized that the Celtic language is alive and well, and that many individuals organize themselves around the cultural renaissance of Celtic culture. And so I think there's a perception out there that, for example, the dying Indian, that treaties are no longer relevant because the real Indians are dying off, and then we're surprised when tribes assert those treaty rights. Or in the East, for example, we thought that most of the tribes were extinct or didn't exist anymore. And now we have tribes like the Oneida and the Passamaquoddy and the Penobscot and the Pequot, who are all very dynamic actors and dynamic political players within their states. So, part of what's been going on since post-World War II, after the Holocaust and after the establishment of the international human rights system, is a recognition of protection of not only indigenous people's rights, but linguistic minorities and ethnic minorities that have historically been oppressed and suppressed by governments, majority governments. And these groups seeking protection either from their domestic courts or international human rights system to revive those aspects of their culture that are important to them and which are guaranteed protection under international human rights law and under most domestic constitutions as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps I should introduce again the guest for this hour, Robert Williams. He's E. Thomas Sullivan Professor of Law and American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona Rogers College of Law in Tucson. He's also director of the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program there. He's authored several books dealing with Indian law, among them a textbook that's used in a lot of law schools on federal Indian law. His most recent is titled Like a Loaded Weapon, The Rehnquist Court, Indian Rights, and the Legal History of Racism in America, published by University of Minnesota Press, 2005. He also has represented tribal groups before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and the United Nations Working Group on Indigenous Peoples. Again, the questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I wonder if you might talk a little bit about essentially the argument that you make in the book Like a Loaded Weapon, and about the role that racism has played in the experiences that Native peoples have had in wrestling over legal questions with the government of the United States, with the American legal system, and certainly all the way up to the very top, to the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's right. Well, most Americans, when they think of racism, you know, think about people walking around in white hoods and the Ku Klux Klan and lynchings. But one of the points I try to make in a book is that every American is familiar with a language of racism of different racial groups. The title of my book itself is from the Supreme Court's decision in Korematsu versus United States, which upheld the wartime detention of Japanese Americans in essentially concentration camps. And the language of racism that was used there was repeated by United States generals and intelligence officials, saying that the Japanese were inscrutable, they were emperor worshippers, they were clannish, they maintained loyalties to their home country and couldn't be trusted. And it was based on that language of racism that Congress and then the United States Supreme Court authorized their detention. We all know the language of racism organized around the history of slavery and the oppression of African Americans, and we all know the racial slurs. The psychological literature shows that children learn many of these racial slurs and stereotypes at a very early age. And I try to make the point in the book that there's a language of racism that we know about Indian tribes. We know about, you know, the noble savage, or we know about the ignoble savage, you know, the bloodthirsty, tomahawk-wielding Indian who is out there on the plains hunting and doesn't have a real organized society and doesn't know what law is. And what you find is that that language of racism is not only part of popular culture in colonial America, for example, with captivity narratives of fair maidens being kidnapped by Indian tribes or of being burned by the stake, you know, colonists who go out over the Appalachian Mountains. But you find that this language of racism, which depicts Indians as savages, as uncivilized, as unsophisticated, as not understanding what their treaties mean, so therefore the United States doesn't have to honor those treaties. You find that language embedded in not only congressional legislation, but also Supreme Court decisions. In the case that we began talking about, Johnson v. McIntosh, decided in 1823 by Chief Justice John Marshall, when he tries to explain why the United States has adopted this doctrine of discovery and why European nations do not recognize Indian rights, he says the tribes of Indians were fierce savages whose occupation was war, and that to try and govern them as a distinct people was impossible because they were brave and fierce and high-spirited. So the only rule that we could adopt was to deny them all rights and to herd them onto a reservation and to manage them essentially as a people who needed the guardianship of the federal government. And from 1823 on, you see this language of savagery and racism repeated again and again when the Supreme Court in the 1900s holds that Indian treaties are not entitled to constitutional protection, that they can be broken by Congress without any justification whatsoever. The court uses the language of savagery and says that the Indian tribes are wards of the government and they're inferior and they need Congress to have this extraordinary power. The Indian boarding schools were justified under this language of savagery. So the point that I try to make in my book is that many of the stereotypes we carry around about Indians in our heads, for example, if your listeners are out there, I ask them to name five Indian people alive today. And as they try and write down, if they're like my students, they really have trouble naming five American Indians. But then I ask them to name five Indian chiefs who killed white people, for example, in the 19th century. And everybody can name Geronimo and Cochise and Sitting Bull. Most of the images that we have of Indians are locked in these 19th century stereotypes of Indians running around in buckskins and feathers and doing war dances and going ugh and how. And if you take those stereotypes today before a court, you know, as I tell my students, imagine if the only image that the judge or the jury has of Indians is of some dancing savage. And then you're there trying to argue for the respect and protection of an important treaty right. For example, the right of tribes to police their own reservations and to arrest offenders who violate their laws and threaten members of their community, regardless of their race. And you can begin to understand the difficulties that racism, which is still deeply embedded in our Indian law, creates for Indian tribes today. It's moving beyond these stereotyped images of inferiority, of inability to govern ourselves, and to move to a world where the right of Indian self-determination, the right to be safe in their communities, is recognized equally for Indians as it is for other people.
Let's talk with another caller here. We have someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Two questions. One is, in terms of the compensation for natural resources and stuff, is that through Indian Affairs? Is that right or not?
The compensation is usually going, you know, let me spin out a couple of scenarios. The federal government wants to create a dam to generate water power to control flooding on the Missouri River. And part of that dam that's going to be flooded, the land belongs to a tribe. And so the Army Corps of Engineers begins the process, evaluation is made, and then it's eventually tested in court. Another example is ongoing right now in our federal courts in D.C. It involves what's called the Cobell case, C-O-B-E-L-L. It's gotten a lot of headlines. It involves a member of an Indian tribe, Louise Cobell, in a class action, where hundreds of thousands of American Indians are suing the United States government for failing to account for their natural resource royalties. On many reservations, there are oil wells, there are other types of agricultural leases and mineral leases, and oftentimes individual Indians are entitled to the royalties or to the payments on the rents for those natural resource rights. And those royalties and rents have been paid into the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they've been mismanaged for over a century, as the court has found. Congress has demanded an accounting from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and can't get one. And so the courts have held that the U.S. is liable for that breach. So compensation then has to be established. But normally compensation is established. It's a legal process. And ultimately, it's a negotiating game where the two parties can't agree, and then you go into court to get the final number.
Yeah, well, I think that's one. The other one is what actually piqued your interest in this litigation or becoming an attorney focusing on this area?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Lumbee Indian Tribes from North Carolina. A lot of people aren't familiar with the history of the Eastern Tribes. Many people don't even know there are still tribes back in the East. But my tribe has a long history of litigation and protect. We're farmers. We're tobacco farmers. In fact, if you go back into the historical records in North Carolina, you see members of my tribe starting to document their land titles and registering their land rights in county courts. And so we have a long history of litigating our rights in the courts and protecting our rights. And so I've had an interest for a very long time in just these issues of Indian rights, treaty rights. And I felt that going into law school and becoming a lawyer and now teaching about it is a good way to carry on that cause.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I'm glad that we got around to talking about the Cobell case. That's something that we wanted to do, and we have maybe about another 5 minutes here, so it's not a lot of time. But this is a case now that goes back more than 10 years. It's now Cobell v. Kempthorne. The second name is the Secretary of the Interior, and it keeps changing because the Secretary of the Interior keeps changing.
That's right. We had Babbitt
It was before that was Gail Norton, and now is so. And as you say, that this is a case, and it has potentially, I guess, hundreds of thousands of class members in this class action suit of people saying that essentially what you've said, that the United States government agreed to manage these natural resources and that for the benefit of Native Americans, and the argument is of the plaintiffs here that that it was mismanaged. The government didn't do what it said it was going to do, and that the people here are owed enormous amounts of money for the mismanagement and the failure of the federal government to do this. How is this likely to? I wonder how you think this is likely to play out now.
Every day I go through the web and the various Indian-related web pages, and I see a new different approach to the Cobell settlement. It's almost become a joke, except there's so much money involved for people who really do need that money. It's an absolute tragedy. It's a national disgrace. It's astounding the dimensions. You're talking about billions and billions of dollars in royalties checks, which the BIA simply just threw into the federal treasury and never even bothered to write down notes, would just accumulate money in accounts and never bother to distribute it. Some of the worst examples of mismanagement. One of the original people brought in to try and sort out the mess had been used by the federal government to try and rearrange the security savings and loan situation a few years back, and having worked on that, looked at this case and said this is far worse than anything that happened with the mess with the savings and loans associations. And so ultimately the amounts are so large, the number of people is so huge, that Congress is going to have to negotiate a settlement. Really, the court case, the Cobell case, it involves a very simple issue. All the litigants want in Cobell, they're not asking for money back. What they're asking for is an accounting. So if you have a bank account and you ask your bank for, you know, a statement on the account, they're required by law to give it for you. And in this case, for more than 10 years, that simple request, show us an accounting, show us a balance statement, the government hasn't been able to do for any of these litigants or for anybody else named in the class suit. And so here's a situation, actually, where the government has so mismanaged its trust responsibility to Indian tribes that it's really going to take Congress coming in and essentially, you know, writing a huge check to pay off all these folks over almost 100 years. That's how long the backlogged accounting is. And so you're going to see a congressional settlement, but the number is so large, that's what's holding it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of number do you think we're talking about?
We've seen plaintiffs estimate anywhere, you know, from $1 to $6 billion and perhaps even more. And we've even seen Congress admit that you're getting pretty close to $1 billion and to the Department of Interior. But, you know, here's the problem. You know, imagine hundreds of thousands of checks that are supposed to be cut every year from 1887 on. That's really when this begins. And the BIA simply neglecting to cut those checks over generations and generations, because each time a generation passes, the estate divides up more and more. And so that's why you have so many litigants. And so that really is the problem.
What is this case? Is it rooted in essentially in incompetence, or
yeah,
is it an active sort of neglect?
If you know, it's interesting. Again, if you sort of read the blogs, Indian people are amazed that the society is so upset about conditions at Walter Reed Hospital. If you look at Indian Health Service hospitals, the same types of problems have been going on there for decades. If you're a Native American, it's very easy to be a libertarian and to hate government, because if you look at just the horrible job that the government has done in managing every aspect of Indian property rights, whether it's these trust accounts, whether it's natural resources, whether it's forestry, the government has messed up in every single instance, whether it's Indian Health Service or Indian education. And it really is, I don't think it's anything evil, I just think it's the gross incompetence of bureaucracies to do the most basic task. And what tribes are saying is, let us do it ourselves. That's what really the tribes want to do, is to manage these trust accounts, to manage their resources, because they have accountability. If you're an elected tribal leader, you're accountable to your people, and you're going to manage those resources a lot better than some bureaucrat in Washington who's basically just passing time.
Yeah. Just as a way of finishing up here, it just seems to me that this is, in a sense, kind of a side point, but it's something that I've thought about several times here in our conversation. It seems that there is a large chapter or series of chapters in the history of civil rights and the struggle over civil rights in the United States that has to do with civil rights and Native Americans that are virtually unknown. At least they're virtually unknown to anybody other than Native Americans.
That's right. There's a great book by my colleague from University of Colorado called Charles Wilkinson called Blood Struggle, and it really is the story of the civil rights struggle of Indian tribes in the 1960s and 1970s. And it's a great story because it is a little bit different from the other minority rights struggles of Mexican Americans and gay Americans and African Americans, because tribes do have this unique status. They're the only group recognized under our Constitution as having this right of separate sovereign self-government subject to congressional power, and they're the only group that has these treaty rights. And so it is it's a different story, but if you look at where tribes are at today and many of the successful tribes, it's a great American story. It does show you the importance of the Constitution, the importance of our legal system in recognizing the rights of this rather unique minority group.
Well, it does, and I suppose that gives us a slightly positive note to end on, that it sounds as if within the last few decades, certainly from the 1960s on, that there has been the United States is doing a much better job of fulfilling its obligations, and that for Native Americans, they have been more successful in securing the rights that to which they were guaranteed, but the U.S. government hadn't always done a terribly good job of doing its part.
I can compress those statements, that tribes have done a better job of getting the government to do a better job. And I think that's the key, that whenever people are allowed to run their own affairs, they know what's best for them, you're going to get better results.
Well, I think at that point we will finish up for this hour of Focus 580 with our thanks to our guest, Robert Williams. He is E. Thomas Sullivan Professor of Law and American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona Rogers College of Law in Tucson, where he's also Director of the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program. Professor Williams, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.